You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Are you a writer with a great screenplay just sitting on your desktop? Are you looking for written analysis of your work by experienced creatives? Are you trying to get industry professionals to read your work, but you don't know how to reach them?
Then enter the Blue Cat Screenplay Competition. Created by veteran screenwriter Gordon Hoffman, the Blue Cat Screenplay Competition has helped unknown writers launch their professional careers for over 25 years.
This year, the Blue Cat Screenwriting Competition will award $18,500 in cash, and everyone who enters will receive a written analysis on their work, and getting feedback on your script is worth, like, a lot.
The deadline to enter is October 30th, but if you miss it, you could still catch their late deadline on December 11th.
Check them out on the social medias at Blue Cat Writers on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube.
So stop waiting to be discovered and send your feature screenplay, TV pilot, and short film script to Blue Cat today. And the deadline to enter is October 30th, but if you miss it, you can still catch their late deadline on December 11th, and you can use our code, all caps, BCHARD23. Three for $10 off.
You know, making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Bissell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker, and my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now for everyone to enjoy on digital and DVD.
I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has made two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life. I'm currently in development on my first horror feature, Best Friends Forever. I'm a distribution consultant who does sales, and I used to manage Sundance's Creative Distribution Initiative. This week, we welcome producer Zach Hirsch to talk about producing his film Follower and the sequel Followers, why he made them both, the length that he did, why he skipped film festivals, and how he was able to increase his budget from his first feature to a second. After that, don't go away, because we play another round of the game. But first, Arik, how are you?
I'm doing well. I'm excited for your movie, because I like the title Best Friends Forever with a horror movie, because then it makes you think, like, okay, do they kill themselves and they're, you know, dead together forever? Do they curse themselves and they're trapped together? Does one possess one's soul? Or there's so many possibilities. It makes me want to watch the movie. So, good title.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm doing well. I'm sort of like, you know, in the stage with The Alternate where I'm like, okay, well, I guess that's it. Movie's out. It's got some good reviews. I did get approached by somebody from a very prominent publication. I don't want to say out loud because it'll jinx it, but they requested to watch the movie to include it in a column that they do about, like, indie films. You know, basically that would be like a bucket list checkmark for me if this happened. You know, I know for other people it's probably like, oh, who cares, whatever. But for me, it'd be a big deal. So fingers crossed. We'll see. I kind of came off a little sweaty, I think, because she emailed me, and then within 2 minutes, I responded, like, here's the link to the movie.
To the writer, you mean you were like, helpful?
That was so fast.
You were helpful and accommodating, and you were prepared.
Yes, those are true things. So maybe you could just not have, yeah, it's all mind things, right? It's all the way that you look at it in your brain. I was prepared. But yeah. I don't know. So, you know, I mean, I'm going to run some more Facebook ads for the movie. We've gotten some little ad tips for the podcast recently. So I'm going to apply those to my movie. And then I'm excited for Austin. That'll be fun coming up. Nothing really exciting going on with the movies. So, I mean, we're out to cast. You know, it's all the minutia of like, oh, this person requested a script. This person is not available, or this person won't read without a cash offer. You know, it's like all those different things that you're getting. It's hard not to get excited when someone requests the script. I know it's like, whatever, such a small stage in the game of them saying yes, you know? So we'll see. Fingers crossed with that. I'm not really doing any writing lately. I've been thinking about writing. I don't know if that counts. Maybe a small amount. I'm reading a script from a listener. I'm reading it and I'm not putting it down. So that's a very good sign.
Ooh, okay.
I started it like a while ago. I read one line or one page, got busy. I read four more pages, got busy again. And then last night I started reading it. And then like I was so into it. I got to page 45.
Wait, who is it?
Douglas Robertson.
Oh, hi, Douglas Robertson. Junior.
So thanks, Douglas, for, you know, checking out the show and for sending the script and for being so positive. Douglas also watched The Alternate and was very kind and was very excited to watch it. So I mean, I feel like, you know, yeah, would I finish the script no matter what? Probably not. If it was bad, I probably would. Even though they watched my movie, I probably wouldn't read the whole thing. But this is interesting. It's an interesting movie. I have lots of thoughts. I'm not going to say anything because I've learned my lesson. But Douglas, great job. I can't wait to finish it. Hopefully, I'm going to be on a plane. Holy moly. By myself without my baby. Oh my God. What a thing. So yeah, I'll have time to read it then for sure. So hopefully you'll be hearing from me in the next week or so. Or if you haven't already heard from me. But yeah, I don't know. Nothing exciting. What's going on with you?
I am like certainly daydreaming about that plane ride. Like I'm more excited about that plane ride than I am about the trip. I'm like, I'm going to read so much of my book. I'm going to read so much of that book. Maybe if Sean lets me, I'll watch some Midnight Club episodes because we're behind. We're only on episode 2. Everyone knows I'm a big Flanagan fan and I'm behind, you know. What's new? So I am going to be launching. Oh, so sorry, Auric. This is not a competition for the podcast, but I'm launching my own Patreon campaign for my horror feature. And the idea is that people who join the Patreon are going to be a part of making the movie with me. Like my whole thing is transparency. My whole thing is opening up the doors of data and how films are made. And you and I are both keenly interested in like education and supporting other filmmakers. So this idea is, I'm going to let people see production meetings. I'm going to let people see iterations of the script. I'm going to let people see my casting lists. Everything that I can show that doesn't compromise someone's artistic or creative process, I'm showing. And I decided to do Patreon because I'm getting to know it because of our Patreon campaign and our account. And it's a system that I like. So I'm going to be launching that. It might even be the launch by the time this episode airs.
Wow.
And so that's taking a lot of my time, is figuring out what I want to expose and how to orchestrate this Patreon campaign to let people in to make this movie with us. That's what's going on.
Interesting. Wow. So a couple questions.
Yeah.
Why Patreon versus traditional crowdfunding? Is there a reason why you wanted to do it this way specifically?
I wanted a platform that allowed for like long-term engagement and automation, right? So it's like, I can just like, one of the perks I want to offer is me and Sean used to be film critics and we watch a horror film a week right now. So it's like one of the perks we're going to offer is me and him talking about a horror film and engaging in a conversation. Like, won't it be easier and more automated if we put together that video, disperse it to that Patreon tier, and then there's like a infrastructure to Patreon.
Oh, I see.
That feels automated, right? It's longer term.
Right.
And yeah, I don't know if it's the tool that I'm trusting right now and that I have the most amount of experience with. I don't have the 30 day energy right now. I have the like year, the 12 month energy. If I had 30 day energy, I'd be doing a Kickstarter campaign.
So are you going to do a horror movie review once a week and then you're just going to have them pile up on Patreon and then whoever gets that perk will be able to watch all your reviews?
I think so. Yeah. And
wow,
we're also cool. Doing like, I meet with Amy twice a week. So we're going to be recording some of those meetings. We're going to share. We have like three very disparate versions of the script right now. We have one from when we first started writing, one that is called like the balls to the wall version where things got a little off the rails. And then we have the current one we're working on. So we're going to share like different drafts of the script that are majorly different. And I'm going to be talking about how I'm going to cast it, how we're going to block shoot, how we're going to edit it, how we're going to do this all while having a family and while having a day job. So it's going to be like a part diary, part confessional, and then part film school, I think, is the plan.
What's the minimum that you have to put up to be a part of this?
A dollar. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And that gets you like some basic access to things. And then if you want like, oh, to read the scripts or to do this, then you pay more.
Yeah. And just with our Patreon, you know, it can be short term involvement. But the goal is, you know, we're not going to finance the entire film from Patreon. But the goal is to start a connection with an audience who's a part of this, who's part of the development. So is there a world where, when it comes to making a location decision or a casting decision, can I go out and say, what do you think of this key art? What do you think of this actor? You're all horror fans. What do you think of this kill idea? Here's an early cut of the first scene. What do you think of it? Like, that's what's exciting me is the longer term connection. Whereas if it's a Kickstarter campaign, I have to maintain that completely outside of, most likely I have to maintain that outside of a system, I think, the Kickstarter system.
Yeah, maybe.
I could send like the update emails and stuff like
that. Yeah, I feel like the update emails are is a place to do that, but it's not like, and you could do the same thing where you just like pop videos up, but like you're right, the Patreon infrastructure is more applicable to what you're talking about, which is nice.
Yeah, community building and really getting immersed in this horror world is like super exciting to me. So that's happening.
Do you want to throw out a call to action? Are you ready to do that? Or you feel like you're not sure if it's going to be done yet, so you don't want to like push people to it?
Oh, well, I mean, if you go on Twitter and you follow me on Twitter, just at Liz Manischel, my pinned tweet is a sign up for the email list for when I launch. So if anyone is interested at all, I would love that. But and I really don't want to be too evil about mentioning it on the podcast too much, but I might mention it in a few weeks down the line again, if that's so cool.
Liz will definitely not be doing any more Patreon videos for Patreon.
No, I will. I will. Actually, there's a better chance now.
Energy is going to another thing.
No.
No, I mean, I totally support that, Liz. And I'm not like, I don't think it's weird or anything, you know, like, what if I wanted to do a Patreon page for a movie that I'm making? Like, you know, I wouldn't want you to be like, no, take it away from podcast patrons, you jerk. Like, no, like we're this is what the podcast is about, is supporting each other, not just us, but like our listeners and everybody as artists. So
yeah,
totally cool. Very excited for you. It's a really interesting concept, which like, you know, that's what people do for, like, musicians do this, comic book artists do this, comedians do this, writers do this. I was, when I was researching critics to, like, you know, reach out to review my movie, I found a few of them who have Patreon pages to support them as critics. Because they get so little money, you know, writing these reviews, and it's like the thing that they do. And so there's a couple on there who had, like, you know, big Patreon followers, you know, and you know, pages and everything. So, you know, more power to you. I'd love to see this being applied to filmmaking in a way that, like, I don't think we see as much. So, yeah, good on you, Liz. And if anyone's heard of other people who do this for movies already, I'd love to see some examples. I'm sure you probably already found some in your research, Liz, but it'd be cool to see how other filmmakers are using this.
Well, in the weirdest segue of all time, don't forget to support us on Patreon. So www.patreon.com/MMIH podcast, the OG Patreon campaign of this podcast, is the one that actually supports the podcast. No, but it is actually how we we make the show. So please support us if you can. Don't forget to check out jambox.io, which is that royalty-free music and SFX company that we talk about all the time. They emphasize high-quality cinematic cues. Their composers have worked on soundtracks for Hollywood-level films, working with directors like Michael Bay, Martin Scorsese, global brands like DJI. Check them out, jambox.io. But without any more delay, here's our chat with Zach Hirsch.
Well, welcome, Zach Hirsch, to the show. Give us the elevator pitch for your film, A Follower. Oh, are we doing followers and followers, too?
Well,
we're doing both?
One's in post, right, Zach?
And yes, one is post, and they are related, if you couldn't tell by the titles.
Yes. Can you speak about both?
Yeah, I could definitely speak about both.
Here, give us the pitch for A Follower, and then you can do followers right after.
Okay, so the elevator for Follower is about an aspiring social media influencer and her two girlfriends who embark on a hiking trip to celebrate their forthcoming futures. As they make their way up the trail, they discover they are being followed by a mass killer who has been tracking their every move and uploading videos of them to a dark web forum where other followers can dictate their fate.
Ooh, that's pretty clever. That's a clever idea.
It's fun.
And then followers, I assume, is just bigger, longer, uncut. I don't know, something to that.
So we're actually, it's a little bit of an experiment with these two projects. So we're calling it a two-part horror anthology, but the twist is each film stands on its own. So you could watch Follower and then Followers, or you could just watch Followers and then the order doesn't matter. So they each stand alone, but together they tell a full narrative. So when you watch Followers and you're like, well, I want to know what happened in the past, you can go back and watch Follower. So the elevator for pitch for Followers is a little bit more straightforward, to not give anything away, but it's a year after surviving a traumatic attack, three friends reunite in an attempt to heal and move on. But the devoted followers of their attacker have other plans in store for them.
Ooh, fun.
Interesting. How many days can you, I guess, answer for both? How many days did you shoot for each one?
So Follower was just 10 days. And that had a very bare bones crew. It was shot kind of in like the heart of COVID in August of 2020. The whole concept of the film came around. What can we shoot with like the least amount of people and the least amount of cast? So there was essentially just director, the cinematographer, and the sound guy for that one.
Wow.
And for Followers, how many days?
So Followers was a little bit more cush. We had 16 days on that one and a much bigger crew and a much more expansive project. We kind of were able to prove ourselves that we could make a feature film with Follower. And then we're able to take that to investors and show them like, hey, we could actually make a movie and get it distributed. So why not make it bigger?
And then what can you speak to with the rough budget for both?
The shooting budget for Follower was $40,000. Then we used the footage from production to fundraise for post. So all together, it ended up being around $80,000. Nice. And then we shot up for Followers and that came in just, it'll probably be like $250,000 when it's all said and done. Nice. So we're climbing the ladder.
Coming up with the idea, how did the team come up with both? Well, let's just talk about Follower. How did you come up with the idea of Follower?
So my partner, James Rich, he's also the director. We co-write everything together. So we wrote this concept at the time when it was kind of like the heart of mass killings that were going on in the US that we were feeling disturbed by. And I think it was something like we used to process as writing to going through like the ethos of the mindsets and like the depravity of these mass killers that are acting these things out in reality. That was kind of the overarching concept to wanting to explore that dynamic. And then we kind of scaled that to really wanting to modernize the slasher trope in kind of multiple dynamics. So one, it was like, what if like Jason Voorhees had access to social media, you know, like, and now we're all so inclined to share our locations and what we're doing and exactly where we are. Like, it'd be really easy to find people if you were wanting to kill them. So the concept of the killer was like, okay, what if he's using the victims like social medias against them? And to kind of fulfill that narrative, we made the main character a wannabe social media influencer. So she's posting everything about her life. Meanwhile, there's someone on the opposite end of the spectrum following them and using that against them.
And then let's just talk about the first one, Follower. How long did you spend working on the film from the idea on to it being released?
It probably took us 2 months to write total. And then once we had it written, it was another month of figuring out fundraising for it. And again, this was during like the peak of the pandemic. So it was trying to figure out like, can we actually go shoot this thing? Like, how can we pull that off? And then once we figured that out, it was from August. So we filmed August 24th to September 2nd, which was the 10 days of shooting. And then post-production, let's see, September, it was about 5 months in post. And then we had it we got like the, we probably took another, I think it was another month for finding a distributor, and then released in March.
Wow. So March of 2022 or March of 2021?
March of 2021.
Wow.
I hate this question. This is the least interesting question. Sorry to cut you off, Zach. Compared to all the other projects you've ever done, how difficult was this one?
So in college, my partner and I, because we met in college and that's when we started making films from like shorts, and we actually pulled off making two features in college. And when we were making those features, it was just me, him, and I would act in them. And he would direct and do literally everything else. Like, he was the full crew, and we would just like go out and film these things. So that was a little, it was difficult, but it was easier to manage because you weren't dealing with like a vast array of people. So those came together. So Follower was, it was definitely a challenge. There was there's like no part of the process between Follower and Followers that was like horrific or like terrible. It was actually pretty enjoyable making both films, I would say. Yeah, I don't know if that fully answers, but yeah, it beats making college films.
So from when you started partnering with James, like what was, like how did you fall into the role of producer? Was it something that you always wanted to do, like to be the producer of the movie? Or was it something that you kind of like just did out of necessity and then kind of fell in love with it later?
No, I actually, when I met him, I wanted to be an actor. I was studying business marketing, and then I had a minor in theater. I wanted to major in theater, but my parents, you know, wanted to hedge my bets there. So yeah, I was wanting to be an actor, and then we made these films, and we kind of, so neither of us at that point knew the business end of the film industry at all. Like, we had the creative desire and want to make independent films, but once the films were complete, we had no idea what to do with them. So we would make them and then like submit them to Sundance. And if we didn't get into Sundance, it was like, all right, we're doomed. You know, next, what do we do next? And that was kind of a big turning point for me when we made our second film, which is called Animal. It was like an MMA movie. And we shot that the summer after I graduated. I was kind of sitting back and being like, this movie's going to come out and get into Sundance, and it's going to like set our careers up. And I had graduated, so there was like no more safety net of college, and I had moved back home. And I'll never forget, like he sent me the first cut of the movie, and I was stoked, and I put it on for my parents, and the movie ended, and the room was just quiet, and I was like, I'm pretty screwed here. So, spoiler, it didn't get into Sundance. And I think it ended up on YouTube. So after that moment, I realized I need to figure out how to take our films to the next level. And that's where I realized I had to go learn how to be a producer and how to learn film finance, how to learn, you know, like distribution. And that's when I journeyed to LA.
And your pitch email to us, you said you became, you know, you went into international sales. Mm-hmm. And which is actually something we talk about on the podcast a lot, is like, I've made two features and I'm only now working with an international sales company, right? Like, yeah. It's something that I think a lot of us are shut out of those conversations, because usually you have to work with larger projects, cast-driven, genre-driven. Can you talk a little bit about how you define international sales and what you did as your jobby job and what you learned?
Yeah. So to get there to that job, like, so I had no idea that was even a career. Like, I didn't know about international sales. Like, I thought, you know, your movie goes out in America and that's it. But I was very fortunate to take, so I enrolled in the UCLA extension program for producing and screenwriting, and I did acting as well. And there I had a very just like amazing film finance class. The teacher was Richard Caratsoulis, and he was like an experienced, I think he was an accountant on a lot of big films. But anyways, it kind of like revealed the whole other side of the film industry that I didn't know, where he talked about international sales and film finance and all this. But one day he said, I have a friend who has a job opening at her company that's an international sales agency. And at the time I was just like blindly sending out my resume to any, if it said film and they're in LA, like they probably got my resume. And that's like a big note. But when you have like some sort of in at one of these companies, it helps tremendously. If it's like an acquaintance or someone that can just say like, you know, we look at Zach's resume. So that's how I even found out that that job existed. And then like I applied and ended up getting an internship there. But yeah, so that revealed the world of international sales and what that process looks like. So now I can kind of like dive into your question. That's just how I got there.
No, it's helpful.
But essentially your film has rights that are available in all different territories. So US and Canada are the normally like the main focuses, and then the UK. However, there's, you know, the whole rest of the world, which is like Germany, France, Scandinavia, Japan, like all of Asia and South, you know, so the whole rest of the world is available. And I think what happens with a lot of independent filmmakers, for example, is for the most part, you're not going to get like a worldwide deal, just like fresh off. Like, so most of these like domestic distributors are just going to want US and Canada rights only. So that leaves the whole rest of the world open. And it's like, I mean, like 99% of people don't know that you can like take your film to the same way you would do it in the US, but a distributor in Germany and then sell the rights. So essentially that's what we would do at the sales agency, mainly via participating in all the markets. I got really lucky. I got the job and then COVID happened. So all the film festivals went online. So where I would have been left behind when they went to Cannes or you know, the Hong Kong Film Art Festival, I got to take meetings on Zoom at pretty much every major festival, and like EFM, AFM, Cannes, and again, like Hong Kong Film Art, and got to essentially what you do as a sales agent is pitch other people's movies to these distributors. And so I kind of got to see what they were looking for in terms of films coming out of the US, what like genres they're looking for, the cast that they were looking for, the quality they're looking for, and how it varied between different countries. So like, for example, in Asia, comedies don't really do amazing because humor doesn't translate that well. Whereas horror and action is kind of like a universal thing. Like everyone can understand being scared, or, you know, like a John Wick fight scene is cool and no matter where you are. So that's actually where I kind of figured out that I wanted to get into horror when I eventually went off on my own, because it's kind of the most accessible genre. You can make horror films super cheap. They don't need to have a significant cast, and you can pretty much score distribution anywhere with it.
Yeah. So is that why you guys made Follower? Because you kind of took those lessons learned from the international experience and like applied it to your own movie? And were there other certain things you did, you know, to try to make yourself more attractable or more attractive? Attractable is not a word. More attractive to international distributors?
I would say it was kind of like a reverse engineering of the formula that I saw that worked, where it was like, you know, people would send in like coming of age drama films that were made at a low budget with no cast. And then just seeing that getting distribution deals for those, even in the US, was tremendously hard.
Yeah.
Whereas I got these like horror films sent to me, I would be like, this doesn't look amazing. And yet we would get offers from like all over the world for it. So just knowing that, and knowing that we were going to be at an extremely low budget and not have access to cast, it was definitely a major factor in the decision of getting into the horror genre.
With Follower, I mean, I did a little sleuthing and I thought it was 63 minutes. And I also love the way you pitch it as part of an anthology. Was the formation of that film, was everything by design? Or were you like, I have access to $40,000. We're going to do our best. We're in the middle of a global pandemic and let's learn. Well, I guess what I'm pointing to is that you seem rather strategic. And so I'd be curious if how much strategy went into that first film in the anthology.
Yeah, no, essentially every part of it was by design. So what we saw, my partner and I, was that, again, like during peak of COVID, like theaters were all shut down. We were seeing a major transition from like theatrical releases to just straight to streaming and straight to VOD and all of those platforms. And the duration of the film was actually intentional, where we had a hypothesis that maybe people on streaming didn't want to watch an hour and 30 minutes to 2 hour movies, but would want to see something a little bit shorter in like the 64 minute range. It was like, the premise was the, I forget the name, but that streaming site that failed because they're making the really short films.
Oh, Quibi.
Quibi. Yeah. Yeah.
Quibi.
That's yeah. Right. So we saw Quibi and then we saw like long features and we were like, let's make something that's like right in the middle. So we landed on that 64 minute. And then with Followers, it's going to be the same time. So if you really do want the full narrative experience, you just put them together.
And did you see that length helping you or hurting you in any way once you went to distributors? Do you feel like that was like a good strategy in the end?
Yeah. So this is actually a note I had to as a warning to people. So broadcasters and streamers and platforms internationally are very strict on the duration of the film. A lot of them do like programming for time slots. So like UK, for example, is super strict on things fitting a formula, like a very standard duration and things like that. So the time initially has hurt us with international sales. However, in like US and Canada, totally fine. Didn't come up against anything yet. We are hoping that as it gains a bit more traction in the US, that it helps bleed into international sales. But yeah, it's definitely an important thing to keep in mind that it will make it a little bit harder internationally.
And looking at the three projects, Followers, and whatever is the third project that's on the docket, it's from like 80,000 to 250 to an anticipated $2 million budget. Can you talk a little bit about the green lighting of Followers? And everyone uses this phrase, like, and then we go to investors, like, yeah. who are these investors? How do you go to them? And how have you been able to do what I think all of us want to do, which is to get bigger and bigger with every project?
Yeah. So the company I was at, they sold movies and they produced movies. And what I saw when they were producing movies was the stress that came with traditional film financing. So, you know, getting like bank loans and foreign pre-sales is a different thing, but having like traditional run-of-the-mill film financers is very cut and dry. You're getting calls every day for like, where's the money? And I didn't want to make movies with that same like level of stress. And so I thought, why not go to people who are not in the film industry? Because for most people outside of LA, film is kind of a cool novelty where it's like this mysterious thing that's like attractive, and it's the film industry and like Hollywood and glitz and glamour. And like, I want to be a part of that. And how can I be a part of that? And so a great way to be a part of that is to invest in films. So I went very specifically to non-traditional film financers and showed them the path of like, you know, that's just like, here's a traditional business model applied to the film. This is how we're going to make it. This is how we're going to sell it. And kind of went that route. And what I saw was like, I think a very surprisingly comparable industry to the film industry is like real estate sales and development. So our biggest financer is a guy who came from that world. And it was very easy to like show him the similarities. It's like, you know, you build the house and then you sell the house. So yeah, that's the route that we went, and I'll kind of continue to go.
And you found these investors. I mean, we're not asking you to give us all your secrets, but were these strangers or were these people connected to you in your network somehow?
Yeah. So, I mean, candidly, for the follower budget with the production budget, that was just like Jimmy and I's life savings plus friends and family that would like put into the movie for the production budget. And then the post-production budget, that was through an acquaintance in my family. And so it is through like a familial network, but the like dynamic like kind of universally applies, if that makes sense. So like,
well, instead of putting your attention to finding the film people, you just turned your attention the other way.
Yeah. Non-traditional like sources of financing.
Yeah. I did the same thing. Just like kind of my network spiraling out from my network until I find people who will, give the movie a shot. So I'm really curious about your distribution experience domestically with Freestyle. So, you know, the movie looks like it came out earlier this year in March of 22. What's the results been like? Do you feel like it was a good experience going with kind of traditional distribution? Or do you feel like, oh, maybe you would have better luck if you'd self-distributed? Or what are your experience now on this end of it?
So that's definitely what my partner and I have been parsing, especially since we have a new film coming and what to do with it. The thing with like domestic distribution, if your film isn't going to like an A24 or a Neon, like, you know, one of these big distribution companies, what I think is the biggest difference is the attention to an effort in marketing. So like A24, Blumhouse, Neon, they, you know, they pretty much take control of marketing. Whereas the mid-range distributors will get your film released. And that's even if like you're lucky, like there's a lot of like potholes and stuff you can fall into, but they get your film released. And then what I and my partner learned here was like the film gets released and then it's entirely pretty much on you to do the marketing. So Freestyle did everything they promised. You know, they've like released the film across all platforms on the PVOD window. And now we're looking into like SVOD and AVOD partnerships, which was our deal from the beginning. So just like purely on like, this is what they said they were going to do basis. They've done everything perfectly. When the time came for like the first distribution of proceeds, there was no struggle. And I've, especially like dealing in international sales, like trying to get payments from like Vietnam or something is just always like a nightmare. So I was very impressed with them that like, you know, when the time for reporting was due, that all came in. But I would say the biggest thing that like, I don't know, it hasn't been great is in marketing. So we kind of realized like, all right, they're not going to market the film. So we have to figure out how to market the film. And if that answers specifically.
Pretty much. I'm just going to go straight to it with a follow-up. Like,
yeah.
Have you seen like any kind of return on your investment on the movie yet? Or is it still kind of like, that's still kind of waiting to build, you know, over the first few quarters?
Yeah, no, I mean, just candidly, the film has so far done about 15,000 in sales, wow. which isn't terrible. And that's just purely like downloads from iTunes, Amazon, DVDs and stuff like that. So, and what we're waiting for now is the transition to, like, as I said, like AVOD and SVOD. We're hoping for like an AVOD deal, maybe with like Tubi, something along that lines, where we start getting like more ad revenue.
Nice.
Commenting on what you said before, I helped the Film Collaborative do these things called the distributor report cards. And literally the number one complaint for every single distribution company, whether it's top of that mid-range or bottom of that mid-range, is exactly what you said, right? It's like no one is actually marketing the work. And it's just about finding the distributor who's not going to screw you over and who's actually going to disperse payments. So I'm glad to hear that about that's all. I like Freestyle, but we can get into it another place. But I wanted to get to your idea of reverse engineering. So, I mean, I think as producers, all of us, to have access to what could be commercially successful internationally is incredibly valuable information. And I'm just thinking to myself, I think, is there something you haven't shared about the makeup of follower and followers that you derived from your workplace? Like, is it these horror films need to have women leads under 30, or they have to have brief nudity, or like, is there something else that you also noticed in terms of at least a correlation of success in genre in international? Or were you not even paying attention to, I mean, your deal with Freestyle may be a North American one, right? So it's like, were you even paying attention to North American, international tropes when you were reverse engineering a successful horror film?
Yeah, no, it was very intentional. And it was a funny conversation that kept coming up between my partner and I as we were writing. So for example, what I learned is like in Asia, for example, you want to hit at certain time markers, like action sequences. So like someone gets killed or something happens where there's blood. And if it's not in the first, you know, like 15 minutes, then normally it gets turned off, especially by distributors. So we wrote this script and then I read it and I was like, you know, no one dies in the first 15 minutes, so we're not going to get a deal. And so now there's like there's a forest ranger character who gets killed. And it's like your character lives so we could like sell the movie. So yeah, there were definitely very intentional things written into the script to help with like sales. It was a funny, just a funny conversation between my partner and I, where, you know, he's coming from like creative integrity and I'm coming from like trying to sell the movie, and then like a back and forth between there. So yeah, it was definitely intentional at times. And then just a side note, we recently closed a deal with the South African company Gravel Road. I don't know if you've heard of them. They're a pretty prominent distributor in South Africa, but they've now branched into doing international sales. So they saw the movie and really liked it, and they partnered with us to help take it and sell it to foreign territories.
Awesome. I only know what the Gravel Road is from a documentary I watched about the Gravel Road in Australia, which I don't know if it's the same Gravel Road, but
it might be.
But yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. So I have two questions. They have to be separate questions. I can't combine them. So the first one is, it seems like you clearly didn't do film festivals, and it seems like that was intentional. Can you just talk about that? Like why you decided not to do film festivals, and, you know, if you plan to do film festivals for a future film, or if that's just not part of your plan?
Yeah. Well, I spent my younger days waiting to get into film festivals. So I was tired of doing that. No, but so kind of what I saw selling movies was, because we also sold movies domestically, and I think that there is this mindset in independent filmmaking community that like my film can't get distributed if it doesn't play at a film festival. And if it doesn't get into a film festival, then the film is dead. Whereas that's not true. I think that what we like people don't realize is you could just go to these distributors yourselves, and it's the same kind of like, so that I guess the concept, and I'm speaking to kind of like more mid-range festivals, not like, you know, Sundance or Tribeca or something like that. If you can win that, that's phenomenal. But like more of the mid-range festivals that you're just waiting to get in, and you don't get in and you think you're screwed. But what we kind of saw is it's better to just, especially with like the horror movie that we made, we kind of knew, you know, this isn't going to win Tribeca, but we can get a distribution deal. So let's save ourselves time and money and just sidestep that and go to distributors ourselves. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think that that's my kind of stance, and what I've been like, what I tell people when they ask about film festivals is they're not the be all end all of getting your film to, I mean, what is like our ultimate end goal is to have our film distributed and, you know, out there and consumed by an audience. So unless your goal is to win Sundance, that's a different story.
Alright, didn't you have another question that you couldn't combine?
Yeah, I did. It's completely separate. But the other question is, you know, you talked about like, you know, making this movie on a low budget, and then like you're taking the next step up for Followers. Knowing what you've experienced in distribution so far with Follower, like what are some of your plans you're making in order to recoup your investment on Followers once that is ready to go out to market?
Followers?
Yeah. Since it's like, you know, a much bigger budget than Follower.
Yeah. So right now we're kind of in a bit of a strategic holding pattern, I would say, where we're trying to see what unveils with the follow. Because like very soon, Follower should be going to at least an AVOD platform. And we want to see what kind of like return that generates, as well as waiting to see what kind of numbers it could bring in internationally. So, and I think you asked this earlier on, but something we are trying to parse is, would it make more sense just to self-release and not have so many people in between us and money? Because what you'll see when you release your independent film, you know, is like, wow, there's this huge line of people now that are getting a percentage before I get a percentage. And you have the platform taking 30 to 35%. You have the distributors taking 22 to 25%. And then by the end of the day, you're getting just like this trickle. So we are trying to parse, like, would it make more sense just to, and now we're in this like world in which it's not that hard to just put your film on Amazon and put your film on iTunes. And then something that we've had tremendous success with on Follower is Facebook ads. And with the Facebook ads, seeing like there's like a 5 cent per click rate to get people to go and click through. So it's like, well, just, you know, cut out, save ourselves 25%, release the film, invest in Facebook ads, and then do international sales to recoup. So we are trying to see that. However, we're also waiting to see if we can kind of pull in a bigger distributor that would be like, so my main question now when I take meetings with distributors is, are you going to invest energy and personnel into marketing the film? And that like, that's the biggest thing that I care about now, because I see like what a big in like there's so many films released every day that if your film's not getting marketing attention, it just kind of disappears. The first two big things are like, are they actually going to release the film? Are they actually going to pay me? Like, pay attention to those. And then the third is like, are you going to market the film? So I think if we can't find a company that's going to market the film, we'll probably go down the path of self-distribution just for the US and then still do international, but we'll see.
My last question is to do with that 250K to 2 million jump. And it, you know, according to the information we have, you're in pre-production on this third film, right? So that insinuates that you have a budget gathered to some degree, or at least you have a plan to greenlight. But, you know, maybe I'm interpreting that a little bit liberally. You tell us, what happened in that jump? I mean, is it your original investors were just so happy with how things happened on the first film that they bring in more people? Are you going out to more communities? Are you going to traditional film financiers? Like, how do you make that jump fundraising wise?
Yeah. And so we're not fully financed, but we're on the way there. And kind of the premise with our film company, so we do everything under the banner of Smaller Town Productions. And what our goal has always been is to have a released film, to have a film in post-production, and then to get a film into pre-production. So like a cycle is always continuously going. I think that that's like the key to survival for a production company. And thus far, it's kind of just been a natural growth. If you can raise 40 grand and pull it off, you can raise like 250 grand, pull it off, and then keep expanding with this film. And we're calling it a vampire Western, is our third film. There's a company. So as I said, I just moved back to Auburn, California, and it's just one of those like things that meant to be things where there's this company that just opened up and they provide post services, but they're also doing equipment rentals for films. And they have just a stockpile of like millions of dollars of equipment that they're looking to use to like rent out to films. So we were able to form a partnership with them, and, you know, having equipment and post-production services covered is like a huge part of the budget. So once you have that, it kind of gives some room to, you know, expand and seek more funding.
Can I press on your answer a tiny little bit?
Yeah.
I just want to stress test it a tiny bit, because Alric and I have both fundraised for our first feature and me for my second feature. I had to go to different partners between the first one and the second one. We recouped on the first feature. Like, we did like The Unspeakable, right? And still had to go to separate partners. So what is the pitch? Are you just confident in the room? Like, do you feel like your success is because of confidence and because of your research and your background? Do you think it's the content? Like, what do you think is the reason you've been able to fundraise this amount?
Well, I always try to go with like strategic planning and like actual like financial analysis and trying to like quantify these decisions. Domestic is a little bit different, but with like international, you can kind of like hypothesize, you know, like 5K for this territory, 10, and then you put together like a rough assembly of what the film can make. But for the third film, and I think that this is like another important note, that it's definitely going to be a film that uses cast. I would never make a film over $200,000 that doesn't have a name in it. Like, we're already meeting with like local SAG reps and things like that to be able to make this a film that can like bring in bigger talent. Yeah, it's just an expansion of everything. With making two low budget films, you kind of can prove like, hey, we can go out and make a film. Like with Followers, we've done that in under a year. So from conception, we'll be like 1 month shy of a year to completion. Both films came in under budget, slightly, not over budget or anything like that. And then to actually like get the films distributed, I think is another big selling point. So it's like, you know, we actually complete the film, can get the film distributed. And now here with this third film, having like a very powerful strategic partnership. Another big part of that partnership is filming it in this Northern California environment where we have access to giant open spaces. And we've already, you know, started partnering with the Film Commission here, where they're really willing and eager, versus like LA, where it's kind of like you're up against like huge fees and stuff like this. But here it's like, oh, we have this giant open space and you could just go shoot in it for free and, you know, do whatever you need. So it's like location plus equipment is huge.
And just to cap off your answer, are you doing a full formal presentation with a deck with all this information, or are you just kind of relaying it the way you are to us?
Both. Definitely there's a deck and there's performas and like the whole nine yards. Yeah.
Just to stay on the same tip, like first off, when is Followers coming out? Does that have a release date already, or what's the status on that one?
No release date yet, but it will be done in January.
Okay. And then you still have to find a distributor for that one, or do you already have a distributor lined up?
We don't have a distributor lined up yet. We are, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the company Ramo Law.
Oh, yeah.
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 Hopefully not bad.
No, very good. Okay, I like Tiffany a lot. Yeah, you're good.
Yeah, with Tiffany. So she actually came aboard and helped us with follower distribution. So we're talking to her now with the upcoming AFM market about just getting her a promo and having her pitch it. So we'll see how that goes.
Okay, cool.
Nice. Yeah. And so then back to the question about fundraising for the third one, is your plan like that you're going to get all the money together, like the total budget, and then make the movie? Or is there like some other strategy where like if you get halfway to the half of the budget, then you can start approaching cast and get them attached and then go get the rest? Like, what is your strategy? Because like if you're really talking about $2 million, like that's a massive amount of money to raise, you know, on your own, like, you know, even with two movies under your belt. So just trying to get a sense of like what your strategy is and how you're able to pull this off.
Yeah, it'll probably be something more like what we did with Follower, where, you know, secure at least half up front and then go out when it's actually, because like, you know, filming it will be a big thing to have in the bag to seek fundraising for part two. And again, like right now, a big thing that we're using for the, I guess you could say, collateral of the film is having access to like the locations for the film and all of the equipment, like cameras and lighting equipment and any piece of gear we would possibly need in our, you know, budget is provided for. So just making sure we have enough to go out to cast and then go to part two.
I love that you're always thinking about part two. That's like crazy. You're like, we're making this first movie, sequel's there, we're going to get to it. Don't worry, we're going to get to it right away. It's like, it's just a kind of amazing sort of process. Last quick question, Liz. I'm sorry to sneak in again. What do you do for your day job? Is this your full job, or do you do something else, you know, in between, you know, taking over the film business with these movies?
Yeah, so this transitioned into my full-time job with the creation of Followers. We were able to take like a producing fee for our company to like make the film. So we kind of like plan that to be able to live off until the release of the film. So we're not in like a beach house in Malibu, but we get to focus on this, which is great.
Wow.
That's amazing. That's so ideal.
Yeah.
Let's transition to our last questions, like our final six. So what's, you kind of talked about it a little bit, unless there are other movies before this one, but what's the first film you have ever made and how do you feel about it now?
You probably find it on YouTube. It's a short film called Insect and I'm the star. How do I feel about it now? I think it's pretty good. There's a part with like a bug in a brain, and I don't know how that is digested, because we just had a little like, we literally put ground beef into a sink and then took a plastic bug and like pushed it across the ground beef, and it was all in black and white with like chocolate sauce. So at least we get an A for creativity.
Amazing. Yeah. What's the best filmmaking advice you've ever received?
Best filmmaking advice I've ever received. I mean, probably get it in writing. I think like contracts are so important in film, and it's such an overlooked dynamic for independent filmmakers. I think I was really shocked when I was sending out the contracts for Follower that people would send them back like 10 minutes later. And I was like, you didn't read this or review it. And so I think, well, maybe it's two part. I'll put my own slice on it. There's like, get it in writing and then you should review it. And then you should have an entertainment attorney review it, most likely.
What's the worst advice related to filmmaking you've ever received or witnessed?
Worst advice. I mean, I think it would be like the opposite of that. Like, we don't need a contract. We could just go forward. Yeah, I'd probably go with that.
I think that was my answer. Ulrich and I asked each other these questions a few months ago, and mine was like contracts. Contracts is the best.
Yeah, contracts are king, especially with your distributor, because you're going to want to have something to point to later and like make sure it's not, you know, oh crap, I thought that was in there, but it's not in there, or that is in there and whatever. So yeah, I also wrote down 7 things I learned for the last 2 movies in preparation for this. So I thought if there's time, I would share.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's do it. Let's interrupt the flow. Let's just do it right now.
Okay. So contract with the distributor, check that payment of proceeds is not quarter plus 90 days. So a big first mistake that I made was I thought we were getting paid quarterly, but it's quarterly plus 90 days, which is a tremendously long time to wait to get paid. So check the payment terms. And then let's see. Yeah, again, like plan on needing to market your own film. That was a thing we covered. And then do not rush the process of picking a distributor. It's like one of the biggest decisions you're going to make. And I think a lot of the times it's like, I've seen a lot of people just accept the first email that they got because they're excited. Like, I can't believe this distributor emailed me and I'm just going to take it. So don't rush that. And then make sure to budget long-term expenses. If you do your film under like an LLC, you want to make sure that you could pay your taxes and those things for the next year to 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. So leaving room in the budget for that, I think it's like an unexpected thing that comes to bite you. Then you have to fund it out of your own pocket. I would say expect to not make money for around 6 months from the film's release. If you have traditional distribution, that was a big shock to me. I thought, you know, money was going to start pouring in the day that the film was released. And then my last note is a big mistake that we made on Follower was we paid for a lot of, so like sound editing and VFX shots and colorization before having a locked final cut. So we paid a lot of money and then just like cut scenes out. So it was a tremendous waste. So my new role making movies now is like, you don't start doing those things until it's like, this is the final cut of the film. Yeah. So yeah, that was what I've learned in a nutshell.
Very good points for sure. I especially like the don't rush the distributor and then saving money for taxes and stuff.
The tax man.
Yeah, that'll get you.
Yeah.
All right, back to our pre-planned questions.
Oh, sorry.
Cool. As a filmmaker. No, this is great. I love it.
I got excited.
What?
I made my list.
They're going to be like extra
information. I saw the time and I was like, oh no.
But yeah, do you have a goal as a filmmaker?
I mean, I would say just to continue with the trajectory we're on, to keep making bigger films and to keep getting to make films that interest us. I think like a big concept between my partner and I is that we make stuff we care about and enjoy making. And so as long as we get to like keep doing that and expanding, and I think just at the end of the day, being extremely grateful to get to work on films for a career, it's like a big blessing. And a lot of people I know like would love to be in that place. So not taking it for granted, working hard, and then just keeping going.
If you could go back in time, what's the one piece of advice you'd give yourself?
I would say, don't sign the contract that says quarter plus 90 days for payment. I would not have paid for post-production services without having a locked final cut for the first film. That was a big waste of money.
I'm seriously gonna double check my contract after this.
Yeah, sure go read your
plus 90. I'm pretty sure it doesn't, but I gotta just check.
Go read your contracts. And then a new one that I have that I just learned on this one is get estimates before work is done, especially with VFX, because a lot of the times VFX can charge like per second. So you want to make sure like when you send a shot before they start working on it, say like, how much is this going to cost and is it worth it? Because, you know, we had like scenes where we had it wasn't even that major, but it's like we wanted this wire removed from a wall just because it looked a little bit better. And then there goes like $1,000. So it's, yeah. Check, get your estimates before it's done.
Yeah, for sure.
Too late. Yeah.
Don't let anyone agree to start working on your thing until they give you a price, which is like sometimes people want to just start going and you're like, no, you have to freaking quote me before I agree. Like, this is stupid.
Yeah. In writing.
There was something you said, oh, about the distributors. Like, don't sign with a distributor so soon. I felt like when I was getting approached by distributors, they wanted me to like say yes immediately. They're like sending me these emails, and then I ask any questions. They're like, oh, well, we'll make it even a better deal. And I'm like, oh, God. Like,
well, that's part of the game. They put expiration dates that mean nothing. If you were to say, can you push back this date? They go, yeah, sure. Like, those expiration dates are just to threaten you and to be predatory.
My my film finance teacher would like refer to people that were easily taken advantage of as like pigeons. So he would draw a pigeon on the board. And then like, if you did like a poor move, it's like, he would point to you and be like, you're a pigeon. And so I guess that was a big lesson too, that I always think of, like, I put a pigeon picture near my desk and I'm like, don't be a pigeon. And he would always say, like, you know, with contracts, or not with contracts, but like with deals, especially for like first time independent filmmakers, we're sitting there picturing our name up in lights, you know, like on the marquee. And that's what we're thinking about. Whereas they have this whole other angle, like they want you to look at that, but not look at the contract and just sign, like sign now, this deal has a 7-day expiration. And it's like, if it has an expiration, then just be like, all right, you know, I'll go on to the next one.
Yeah.
Wow. Final question. Is making movies hard?
It is hard. It's very hard. There's a lot of, I think what my partner and I have found the most difficult process in filmmaking so far is all the waiting. Like you're kind of like your film gets made and you're waiting to get a distribution deal. And then you're waiting once the film's distributed for like, you know, to take off or whatever. So it's just these long agonizing periods of waiting. I think that's what, you know, you don't see from the outside is just us sitting around, you know, waiting. So yeah, it's hard and it's painful, but you know, hopefully it's worth it.
Send people to where you want to send them. How can they support you?
Yeah, so pretty much everything can be found at our website, which is smallertownproductions.com. And then our social is the same, just Smaller Town Productions for Facebook and Instagram.
Easy. Thank you for being on the show. Ulrich, what do you remember about our chat with Zach?
I remember that it kind of felt like, oh, it is just that easy. You can make multiple feature films and produce them and fund them. And it's just that easy. Like, Zach's got to figure it out, you know, and he doesn't have a day job anymore. He's just making movies and it's the whole thing. It just seemed like, wow, like this guy just followed some steps, you know, had some movie ideas, worked with a partner, and then now he's a full-time filmmaker, you know, and it kind of seemed crazy. He made it look so easy, you know, and it's not easy, right? Like, it's very hard to do what he's done, but he made it seem like a very easy way to be a sustainable filmmaker. So I felt like, oh man, that's like pretty interesting that like he just did it and figured it out, you know, and like anyone can do what he's done with it, with his team. But it also just seemed like there's a lot of success behind what he's done that is not easily done, you know, to actually follow through and make two movies, you know, back to back, basically, and then already have a third lined up to go. It's like, that takes a lot of dedication and a lot of hard work and a lot of really good planning. So I feel like anyone who wanted to go out and like make feature films and just do that thing and like nothing else is important, it's just making features, I think this is like a really great episode to listen to.
Yeah, I remember thinking he was a hustler, like in the best way. He hustles. I also feel like I came up with a question right now that I wish I asked him, which is, he learned so much from international sales and the genre tropes of international sales. Like, he talked about like kills within a certain few minutes, or, you know, whatever, all these things that he identified looking at different countries and the way they present and release horror films. But we didn't talk with him about an international distribution strategy for his films. So if he's like deriving all these lessons from other territories, is he going out to other territories to release the films? Because he has a sense of what's successful. I think he talked about like South Korea. Am I remembering this right?
Yeah.
So if he has a sense of what could be a successful title in South Korea, like why not make the film that has all of that in an American marketplace and then supplement his income with a focus on South Korea? Or why not cast with an international perspective? Or I guess I was just thinking, like, he's taking all the lessons he learned internationally and focuses them on domestic titles, but there's a missed opportunity there to think more globally in the construction and the release of the film.
Yeah, he touched on it a little bit. And I think part of the reason is because like the international markets are really star driven, you know,
right.
And his movies weren't at that level yet to have the star power, you know. So I think that was probably one of the reasons why he didn't really focus so much on international for these early titles, because, like, you know, all the other things that he talked about and all these details he learned in international distribution apply. But I think, like, the bottom line to it all that needs to be true along with those things is that it has to have cast, or it's really hard. Because that's what we're fighting up against right now with the alternate, is like, we're getting a lot of no's, and it's mainly just because we don't have cast, you know? But AFM's coming up a couple weeks. Fingers crossed. Maybe we'll get a sale out of AFM, or a few sales to some foreign markets. So we'll see how that goes. But yeah, I really felt like this was a great conversation. It kind of surprised me because it didn't go the way that these conversations normally go with, you know, filmmakers who've made one or two features.
Right.
It was very kind of different kind of conversation, which I really enjoyed.
And he pitched himself to be a part of the podcast. And also, you never know if that's like an effort in self-promotion or if there's really someone who has something to share. But it really felt like he was like, oh, I tapped into this thing I learned and I want to pass it on to others.
Yeah, it wasn't just like, look at me, I made a feature film, which, no offense to anyone who pitches us that, because that's totally a valid thing, you know, like, right. You know, the struggles of making your first feature is like a real deal. But we've done that episode like at least 50 times. And so, you know, bringing another person on the show, it's like, it's got to be a little bit more than just that bottom line story, like of all the, because like, you know, when people pitch us like all the crazy things that we had to do to make our movie, it's like, yeah, we've heard all the crazy things millions of times. You know, everyone knows the crazy things, but it's like, what's the secret sauce? It's doing it again and again, and like doing something different than everyone else who's like struggling just to get one movie made, you know? So that's what appealed to us about Zach. And I think he totally delivered on that, you know? It wasn't a letdown. Because sometimes people say that and then you're like, oh, that's not anything special, but not Zach. He's the real deal.
I think it's time for...
The game.
I don't, you're just better at it. I just can't compete.
It was fun doing it together.
So every week, Eric Toms, our producer, sets up an indie film quagmire, a problem for an indie filmmaker to solve. Ulrich has not heard this question. He's going to hear it for the first time right now and let us know his opinion of what he would do if he's in the situation. So Ulrich, are you ready?
I am ready. Hit me.
Okay. You're attached to direct the biggest movie you've ever been offered. You are brought on early and helped guide the whole process from casting leads to location scouting to scheduling. As the process has progressed, the script has gone in a whole new direction and you don't agree with major story points. To make things worse, there are elements of the new story that you find kind of offensive or that perpetuate stereotypes that you disagree with. It is now extremely close to the first shoot date. Do you? 1. Go along with the script as is and hope to maneuver around the problems, shooting alternate takes that tell more of the original story and possibly save the film in post. 2. Leave the project outright, knowing that this will harm your reputation and could possibly destroy your career. 3. Give an ultimatum that either the script goes back to its original story or you leave. 4. Try and make a compromise that in your eyes won't save the film, but at least would make it more palatable or other. What do you do, director? What do you do?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That's tough.
Yeah.
And it's funny. I was going to say like, oh, well, I would never be in this situation because like, you know, if all the other parts of the setup were true, that I was involved in it from the beginning, like I was involved in all these stages of it, that like clearly I would not be... You know, I would be involved enough to like be reading script drafts as they're happening. And if it started to go south, like I would be able to intervene and make it not go south early on.
Right.
But the other part that makes me think like, well, if it is actually happening and you are actually making a movie, there is a chance that you're so focused on all the other parts that like, you know, maybe you let the script changes, like it happens without you noticing, or maybe one draft is great. And then the next draft you get is like got all these problems in it and it's terrible. That definitely could happen. And then if you get an executive producer sign off on that script and they love it and everyone's go, like, you know, you're in a terrible position. So I really respect this question. I think it's a really hard question and I can see it happening. So what do I do? Man, the ultimatum thing is tempting, you know, because it's like, you know, if you did go into a movie like thinking you were making one movie and then suddenly they're giving you another movie to make, it's like you could totally say like, look, like this is not the movie we discussed. This has all these problems outlined. Like this is offensive for this reason. This feels dated. This is, is just wrong to have this in a movie, you know, like we can't do this, guys. Like, this is just not cool, you know? So I think I would try, before the ultimatum came, I would try to find the compromise of being like, look, like some of these new ideas are good. These new ideas are all bad. Like, cause you don't want to just like say it has to be one thing. You got to go back to the original and not try to work with people. Like, you have to try to work with people. You have to be collaborative. Right. Like, that's the whole point of filmmaking. It's a collaborative medium. So I feel like throwing down an ultimatum without trying to solve it together first is like the wrong approach. So I think I would do everything in my power to work with the writer, work with the production team, the executive producers, whoever loves this version of the script, like work with them to maintain the things they love about the new version while getting rid of the offensive, negative, like icky parts completely. So like you get rid of those and then you keep the new good stuff, because there's gotta be good stuff in the new stuff, right? Mm. And then I would say if that fails and like there's no way that their version of what they like in the new stuff can be separated from the bad stuff and the offensive, you know, completely inappropriate stuff that you can't put on camera or feel good about putting in camera as a filmmaker on camera, on screen, you know what I'm saying? Then I think it has to be the ultimatum. That's like, look, like I'm not going to direct this movie if there's this shit in it. Like, this is, I can't live my life knowing that I contributed to something negative in the world through a movie I made, no matter what it means for my career or no matter what it means for, you know, my reputation. It just doesn't matter. Like, money, it doesn't matter. Like, if you're going to be putting a movie out in the world, you can't have something that you're not proud of or that is especially negative. Like, the whole point of making movies is to have a positive impact on the world. But if you're pushing forward negative stereotypes or like doing something that's so dated and icky or like homophobic or whatever it is, like, it's just wrong. And I can't, you know, be a part of that, you know? So yeah, that's my answer. What would you do, Liz?
Well, I agree. It starts with the conversation. I totally agree with that it's a conversation first, and then you kind of take a step. My first thought went to, how offensive is it? Like, I wanted to know, like, what was this, right? Like, I think there's certain things where there are movies I love that poke at taboo things to prove points, to make people uncomfortable, you know, especially in the comedy space or in the horror space. We watched Terrifier yesterday, or I watched a part of Terrifier. There are many moments in Terrifier that are very extreme, but I will say that can I give away something in Terrifier? Is everyone going to get angry at me?
I haven't seen it, but I think I could survive if you give away something in Terrifier.
I will say that the main villain does something to a woman using a saw that is pretty awful. but it was like, oh, well, I've never seen that before. And God, that's provocative and horrific and upsetting. But visually, wow, how did they do that? Like, it pushed boundaries and was super gross and horrific, but also like interesting. Compelling, scary, button pushing. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, if it's offensiveness, not in the pursuit of pushing boundaries and conversation starting, then yes, I don't want to be a part of it and I'd like to separate myself. But it really depends, and it feels a little bit of a vague situation, right? I would like to know what Eric had in mind. I choose option 5, which is other. And the other is, I would leak whatever the offensive material is and let the court of public opinion steer the studio, right, if they're not listening to me. And whether that's me being a part of it or me not being a part of it, it feels
you
like...
You would leak it? Who would you leak it to?
To the press. I think that people are more worried about being thought of as racist than actually worrying about whether they are racist or not. And I think you use publicity to steer them in the right direction. If this is a race issue, or if this is a sexism issue, whatever it is, right. I guarantee you Twitter will rip this person to shreds if you leak anything that's of marginal offensive material to social media. And so I would let that help sway the studio in the direction of changing the material back to what it should have been.
And that's only after all.
Yes, only after you talk to them. That's not my first step.
Other things.
Yes.
You don't go ultimatum, you go leak.
Yeah, and say, probably.
Hey, look, I'm right.
I mean, that. I'm not going to be.
Dastardly.
I'm not the one who admits they leaked it. I'll be like, I don't know. How did they get out? That's so crazy. What's going on? But yes.
Studio heads, listen to this episode for future reference.
Yeah, no one's going to hire me. Yeah, I'm not worried.
I'm pretty sure you're wrong about that, Liz.
One day someone will hire me. I'll probably be meek as a mouse and never do anything like this. But in this theoretical world of the game, I have ovaries of steel and I make decisions like this where I leak the script and I get them in trouble through the court of public opinion.
I love it. I might steal that. That's great.
Yeah, let's do it. We will leak the script. We'll get them in trouble. We'll get what we want.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. Brilliant. Great question, Eric. I really like this one a lot. I like that you had a very different answer than me, Liz. This is money. What would you people do out in the world? Do you side with Liz? Is the leak the way to go? Or do you go with if everything all breaks down, do you go with the ultimatum? I'd love to hear what people would do in this situation. If you have a thought, you can send those ideas and thoughts to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com, or you can just send a simple question, comment, or suggestion to the same email. You can also leave us a review on iTunes if you really love the show, which we would love. You can also check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at MMIH Podcast, and YouTube at Making Movies Is Hard Podcast. Our editor, Jeff, has done an amazing thing, and he made all the video versions of all the episodes that are not on YouTube for us, because he is my hero, and now I'm going to upload them all to YouTube probably today. So it'll be updated very soon for all those YouTube fans out there. You can also check out the International Screenwriters Association, the ISA. They're an organization designed to connect writers with filmmakers through a number of programs they offer, including publishing your logline to a network of industry professionals, consultation courses, contests, and of course their top 25 writers list featuring some of their best writers. So head over to www.networkisa.org to sign up for free today. Thanks so much to Zach Hirsch for coming on the show and for reaching out to us in the first place, which is just amazing. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Rymoot, for doing the editing. And thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for simply being awesome and creating awesome game questions for us every week. Thanks to you all for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.
All right, do you need to check your settings? How are you doing on your end?
I'm doing okay. I just realized I didn't save our last set recording, so I'm just doing that now so I don't lose it like I did one recently.
Wait, which one? Should we be telling Zach this?
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.